for lots of great content. Catch you then.
This episode of Word for Word may contain language or themes that are not suitable for all listeners. If you're experiencing difficulty, please reach out for support. You can reach QLife, an anonymous and free LGBTI support service, by calling 1-800-184-527 or call Lifeline 24 hours a day on 131114 for crisis support and suicide prevention. In an emergency, please call 000.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network to over 70 community stations around the nation. This is Word for Word, hosted by Lisa Dano Daniel, coming to you from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy.
Welcome to Word for Word. Today's guest is an activist, advocate, actor and athlete, and rarely gets paid for any of it. As a proud and visible trans woman, Emily Fox is passionate about developing accessible spaces for trans and non-binary people in sport. Welcome to Word for Word, Emily Fox.
Thank you, Lisa.
Now, Em, I wanted to start off with you by asking about where you grew up with your family. I wanted to ask questions about your family and your siblings. Whereabouts? Are you Melbourne born and bred?
I was born in Melbourne. I was born in Dandenong. So I guess even though I've transitioned, I'll forever be a Dandy boy. But my family moved around a lot until 1989. We settled in a town called Drildery in southern New South Wales in the Riverina. And I lived there up until I was 17, and then I moved to Melbourne to go to university.
And do you have brothers and sisters?
I have an older brother, and he lives with his wife and children in the country, and I have a younger sister, but she passed away when I was 18 and she was 16 from leukemia.
And do you talk about her much? Is she someone that's still in your life in memory form, or do you actually think about her much?
The only photos I have of anybody in my house are pictures of her and her and me as kids, because she was my best friend and she was one of the few people in my life I could always be 100% true with. And even though she was 2 years younger than me, she was an incredibly smart, gifted person, and very empathetic. So she was the only person I really had as a confidant growing up, and losing her was definitely heartbreaking for me. And if anything, it just made me shut down as a person and just ignore my emotions for a long time.
Was she a supporter of yours?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, we used to fight like little sisters, you know, but at the same time, we used to have some amazing experiences as well. I remember she had got diagnosed with leukemia when she was 11 and relapsed again when she was 15. And I remember like the night or a couple of nights before she had to go to hospital for a checkup where they found that she was really sick. She had a major tumor suddenly had developed in her chest. That night before she went to hospital, I was just sitting on the couch with her, helping her do her homework for hours. And that was like the last normal experience I got to have with her until she spent pretty much the rest of her life from that point on in hospital.
How does having a sibling with a very serious illness that, you know, caused her death in the end, how does that impact a family where there's, you know, three kids, a couple of parents? Does it become about them and their journey?
It does, and fair enough too, because it's a massive fight. I suppose the challenges we had around Michelle's diagnosis was that we lived in rural New South Wales, middle of nowhere, so we're approximately four-hour drive to Melbourne or a 7.5-8-hour drive to Sydney, but there was no regional spaces where you get treated for cancers, particularly childhood cancers. So we spent a lot of time in Melbourne, so Michelle could get the chemotherapy, radiotherapy, everything she required. So it was disruptive, definitely, for our family. And obviously, we all had to focus on Michelle's health and well-being, which meant that I know personally, I probably didn't react very well to that because I had a lot of issues around trying to figure out my gender and sexuality anyway. But I had to stay in the background because Michelle was the most important. And I was totally okay with that because I love her so much. But at the same time, when I reflect, it does probably impact a lot on who I am now and how it took too long to get to be who I was always supposed to be, because I was always focusing on other people and not focusing on myself at all. I actually realized I was a transgender person when I was 19 or 20 years old.
Yeah.
And I didn't transition until I was 33. Well, not necessarily, because growing up in the 90s, there was no such thing as transgender people. There was female impersonators or transvestites, or cross-dressers, the whole concept of not feeling aligned with the gender you're assigned at birth was totally fetishized or a joke. So there was no frame of reference for how I felt. I was not a transvestite. I was not a man who dressed up as a woman fetishizing my identity. It wasn't who I was, but that was the only option we had. The only representation of trans people when I was growing up was through popular media, and it was always the joke. And with that frame of reference, I couldn't understand why I was attracted to the boys I played football with, but in the sense I kind of wanted to be like their girlfriend. I wanted to be like their girlfriends that they had at the time. But at the same time, growing up in a place like that, you couldn't be gay either.
So you just stifled it, do you think, or you kept it hidden from yourself even?
Oh, yeah, definitely, because I didn't understand how I felt. But you look back at photos, like I captained my under-17s football team, and there's photos of me at our club best and fairest. I'm on the microphone addressing the team and the coaching staff because I am the captain of the club, and I'm standing next to our most famous football identity from Geraldry, who happens to be Billy Brownless.
Oh, wow.
So there's photos of me standing next to Billy, and I'm barely up to his belly button in height with really long, pretty hair and a really ridiculously big T-shirt that practically looked like a dress. And it's like, how did people not know? Like, I had long, pretty hair right throughout high school because I just needed it. I would spend Friday nights, Saturday nights just brushing my hair, lying in bed and wondering why I felt different.
Did you keep that stuff from your family?
Well, you couldn't really express it. Mm. It was almost impossible. I mean, they probably knew that I was different, but in what context? I mean, I was always the difficult child. I had a lot of mental health issues, so.
How did you go at school then?
Apparently, I did good. I hated school. School was a nightmare. I got bullied pretty relentlessly all the way through.
What sort of bullying do you think?
Mainly around my feminine expressions that people would notice, which when you do that as a young person, it's not even considered it could be actually a part of your gender. It's immediately applied to your sexuality. So I got the poof, the homo, the faggot, stuff like that. I guess by the time I hit 15, 16, I just kind of owned it and grew my hair long and just didn't care anymore. I mean, by the stage you get to, you know, that age at high school and no one wants to be your friend, well, who cares? You're not going to make friends now, so you may as well just be better, feel better about who you are.
Did the constant accusations of being gay make you think that perhaps you were gay?
Possibly. Yeah, definitely. I mean, with my gender issues, I didn't know how to deal with my sexuality either. I mean, I've got to be honest, I did play around with a couple of the boys that I was friends with and played football with from the age of 14, 15, 16. And I immediately assumed all the issues I had about my identity were attached to my sexuality as well, because there was no concept of whether your gender could be fluid.
So you got to about 18, 19, you've lost your sister, and you come to a point where you think you can start coming to terms with this, or something in your life happened?
I was exposed to the concept of queer people. Yeah. When I'd moved to Melbourne, I was briefly at university, but with my sister being really ill at that time, university wasn't a right fit, and I was too immature. I mean, I was 17 when I was starting university.
I was 17 too. It's very young.
It's too young.
Yeah.
And I was like, I did not, like, I repressed so much of my identity that I was like a 17-year-old who was probably still like a 12-year-old in a lot of senses. So to go into that space, university was just no good for me.
I can relate to that a lot, actually, because I grew up in the suburbs and I was 17 when I first started uni. Mm. And I remember thinking, you know, I was considering my sexuality from about 15, I guess, and going into first year uni, I thought, I'm going to reinvent myself and be this lesbian person. And mm-hmm. I just couldn't do it.
No.
It took me another couple of years to...
Yeah, well, you don't want to be different. Nobody wants to be different.
No, you want to be invisible.
You want to be invisible. Nowadays, I embrace being different. Normal is boring. But back then, you didn't want to stand out lest you get attacked for it. University didn't work, so I got a full-time job working at a supermarket on Chapel Street in Paran.
One of your dad's franchises?
Yeah. Part of the business he was a part of. So starting there at the supermarket in Paran, suddenly I was exposed to queer people because that was, for a long time, a very safe community for the community. And I started to be exposed to people. We had a person who worked on our staff who was a trans dude.
So that was your first exposure to someone in person?
Yep. And they were tough and strong and, you know, like most trans dudes, once you've been on T for a while, it's all about the biceps and how huge you've gotten and stuff. So this person was a bit of an eye-opener for me. But then some of the customers as well were so different. Like, you got customers going out buying cat food wearing their PVC bodysuits. It's Paran. So
Paran in the 2000s?
Yeah. 2000, 2001-ish. Yep. So, yeah, that was a real eye-opener for me. And I started to think, well, maybe something's happening. And I remember being on the registers one day and I put the wrong mandarins through the thing. So the customer starts screaming at this stupid girl who's ruined everything. And I kind of realized, when I realized I wasn't getting offended by that, I thought, what does that mean?
Like, best insult ever.
Yeah. So that's when I started to explore the concept of transgender people, or transsexual as the language was then, and what the concept was around transition. And as I dug into it and early internet to try to learn, I mean, literally sitting at the library using the internet because we didn't even have a computer in our share house. And that's when I found out about the really harsh gatekeeping rules around transition at that time. And I just knew that there was no way I could survive that.
What do you mean when you talk about gatekeeping?
So with gatekeeping, essentially any aspect of you affirming your gender identity, you have to get permission from psychologists or the medical professions, things like that. So back in around 2000, 2001, pretty much you had to get permission from a psychiatrist, which still isn't too different now. But back then there was this whole concept that unless you could attain a cisgender heteronormative concept of feminine beauty, they didn't want you to do it. Because the whole point of transitioning was people weren't supposed to know that you're transgender. I've spoken to people from around that time who did transition where they're actually encouraged to move interstate so they could start again. You had expected to cut off all social ties to go somewhere where people won't know that you're trans.
So it was all about passing.
It was all about passing. And even then, there was this whole thing called real life experience, RLE. Sure, they said you can transition. So what you had to do is then you had to adopt a hyper-feminine identity at all times for 2 years, full face makeup, feminine dress, like what's perceived to be feminine dress, so dresses and, you know, blouses like what your nana would wear kind of stuff. And
so
you
based
had
on stereotypes.
It was deaf. Yeah, you had to look like what they think women should look like. And you had to do real life experience for 2 years without any medical interventions either. Once you got through those 2 years, then you'd get granted permission to go on HRT. HRT wasn't really something that was the big part of it. It was more about you have to get the surgeries. You're not a real woman until you have a vagina. And you need to get a breast augmentation and you need to get facial feminization surgery and you need to learn how to feminize your voice. And it was all about you need to carve everything up and get it reconstituted and put back into your body so you look like what they think a woman should be. And I was poor. I had bad mental health. It was a nightmare. So I'm like, I can't do this and I'm not going to do it. So I had to try to figure out how to affirm a masculine identity for what I thought was going to be the rest of my life.
Is much changed in 20 years in terms of the whole idea of passing?
I think there's a lot more people comfortable with the fact that you don't have to pass, because for a lot of people, they never will. And it's not fair that you should be ostracized because you never will. And it's not something we should have to pursue, because being transgender shouldn't be something that we should feel like we have to hide. It's just a natural variation of the human condition, and if anything, should be celebrated. And if you're a transgender person that doesn't look traditionally like what people think a woman should, so what? They're still a woman. Treat them with respect. Respect their pronouns and their identity, regardless of whether they're 6'8" with broad shoulders and a square jaw. It doesn't matter. They're a woman, and you should just accept that.
Well, we need to accept that it's between the ears and the heart rather than what the external shows.
Well, that's it. I mean, I remember early in my transition, when I still had close contact with my family, I was driving to the local Chinese restaurant to pick up takeaway with my 6-year-old nephew in the car, just me and him going for a drive. And he asked the question, like, why are you a woman now? Why have you changed? And I had to explain that my whole life I felt like I was a woman, but I wasn't allowed to be. So I had spent my whole life trying to change my mind to match my body, and it didn't work. So now I'm changing my body to match my mind, and that's who I really want to be. Explain that to a 6-year-old, and they go, oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Pass me a biscuit.
Yeah, that's good. Good for you kind of attitude.
Do you think – now, here's a I'm in my 50s, so, you know, older
generation.
No
way!
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much, Emily, my new best friend. Some of the trans people I grew up with, in terms of when I discovered the gay scene and the queer scene, really were desperate to pass. So the older generation of trans people I meet, generally are very focused on passing. The younger generation trans people I meet are less kind of stressed about that aspect of it. And the whole gender queer thing seems to be a much healthier way of approaching it.
Definitely. Like, I don't identify as non-binary. I'm really comfortable identifying as a woman who happens to be transgender, but I totally respect people who are non-binary. Gender is a spectrum, and it, like, they should not have to conform to societal expectations of that binary if that doesn't suit who they are.
How did you go in terms of privilege? White male privilege.
I had stacks of it, and I was aware of it too, and I kind of resented myself for it. I hated my job. I had a job for 10 years as a sales executive for a major beverage company, and I hated my job, hated it so much. But I was good at it because I was an attractive white man who could tell jokes and was friendly, and I hated myself, genuinely hated myself, because I was aware of that privilege that I didn't have to work for. I didn't earn it. It was just placed on my shoulders, and it gave me all these opportunities that my friends of color and friends of different genders and friends of different sexualities didn't have. I would try to call out the people I worked with if they were using misogynistic, homophobic language, and it was always like, oh, you know.
Who's this dude?
Who's this dude?
What's his problem?
Yeah. I'd defend women and they'd be like, what are you, a poofter? And it's like, where's that come from? There's no relation to that, but like.
And now that you don't have as much privilege, Emily?
That sucks. I can't find work. I used to own and manage a supermarket, and I can't get a job as a casual sales assistant anywhere in retail because nobody wants the pardon language, nobody wants the tranny freak in a customer-facing role, lest the customer be put off or offended. I've only had very intermittent work over the last 2 years since I transitioned, regardless of my skill set.
That's devastating to hear that.
So I owned and managed a successful business, my own supermarket, and 12 months later I'm homeless and doing survival sex work so I can buy food. That shouldn't happen to anybody, but it does, and it's a very common narrative in the trans community. I know an incredible amount of trans people where the only option of income they have is by doing survival sex work. Some people love it and enjoy sex work, and all power to them. It's a legitimate business, but nobody should have to be forced into that just to survive.
Yeah, God, it's... I'm almost speechless, really. I mean, I know this rationally, but every time I hear it, it shocks me still that in a cosmopolitan city like Melbourne, that someone as skilled as you, with the work experience that you have, who's clearly an intelligent person, struggles to find a job.
I probably need to feminize my voice so they don't feel too uncomfortable with who I am. But it's not me.
No, it's not you.
It's not me.
Yeah.
No. And I've got this strange dissonance where as an activist and an advocate, I can stand up in a room of 400 people who have paid $300 a head at some fundraising gala and share insights about trans identity and how we need to make life better and my journey through football, etc. And they'll all be like, wow. And then the following night, I'm possibly having sex with one of their husbands for a couple hundred dollars just so I can pay my rent this month.
Yeah. It's full on.
Yeah, really it's full on. Weird.
Yeah. How are your family with you, now that you've transitioned? So it took you about 10 years to get to that point. Why did it take 10 years, do you think?
It changed for me when I had children. That was the thing for me, because when my wife and I started our family and I watched her belly grow with our child growing inside her, and then our son was born and I got to watch her breastfeed and all that, that made me realize the things that I'm missing out on as a woman that means so much to me.
How old were you then?
When my son was born, I was 32.
Mm-hmm.
When my daughter was born, I was 34, I think, yeah.
You look so much younger than that.
Estrogen is a time machine, honey. It's amazing. If you saw me 4 or 5 years ago with my massive red beard and sharp haircut.
Just writing notes to myself now. Get a prescription for estrogen.
Estrogen, load up.
You partnered up with a cisgendered female.
Yeah.
Was she aware of your gender feelings at that stage?
No. Like, I mean, I suppressed them pretty well. You kind of build a facade and learn how to be the man society expects you to be. But it's exhausting because you have to repress all your natural innate senses of how you express yourself. So constantly I had to think about, how does a man talk? How does a man stand with his body language? How does a man react to people? And it is exhausting. It's you're constantly on. And interestingly enough, if I ever let my guard down, which would usually happen, like if I had a couple of drinks and I was with friends and suddenly I started talking how I normally talk, or I got expressive with my hands, immediately, once again, it was applied to my sexuality. And I was pretty open with the fact that I identified as bisexual from my early 20s. So, but even then, do a little bit feminine and it's like, oh, maybe they're not bi, maybe they're just a repressed gay man. Honestly, my wife didn't see it coming at all, which surprised me, because she got to see me at my most vulnerable and intimate, and I was much like I am now in those spaces. But yeah, totally blindsided her, which really blindsided me.
What was the turning point for you to actually decide that this is, you wanted to transition, you need to transition, this is what you want to do, and then you need to come out to her and your parents?
To everybody.
Everybody. What was the point of no return for you?
It's like the analogy of like the water dripping into a bucket. It just drips and drips and drips, and you don't really notice it until suddenly that bucket is full and it spills over. So there was lots of little things, like the birth of my son, then the birth of my daughter, not long after that, getting ready for my wedding. We got married, and I got married with a masculine identity, and that was really hard for me. My wife wore her mother's wedding dress, which meant we didn't have to buy a wedding dress. So I went and spent that money that we put aside on a really nice tailored suit, because that was my wedding dress.
But you weren't wearing what you felt yourself in.
I have kept that suit. Yeah. I do plan to wear it again one day, maybe as a drag king performance. I don't know, but I've kept that suit. Not much of my male clothes that I keep, except for my collection of band T-shirts going back to the mid-90s.
I don't sell those. Have you kept photos of yourself in your former incarnation?
Yeah.
You're not one of those people that just...
No, I can't hide who I was. Yeah. That person was an incredible, important person for all my family and friends their whole life. Well, I'm not going to hide who that was. I'm more than comfortable showing people photos of what I used to look like, because it's still me.
Yeah, it was part of your journey.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can't erase that.
No. Goodness no.
I know it is painful for some trans people to look back on that.
Yeah, definitely. Especially if dysphoria was really strong, they really struggle with it. The only way I can look back on that and it's challenging for me, is just knowing that I had such a good life and I was actually pretty happy. I wasn't the person I was supposed to be, but the life I'd built around me was a lot of comfort in that. Like when I transitioned, it wasn't like I was at the I wasn't in the deepest trough and I knew I had to do it. I was actually at the highest peak and I realized, if this is as good as life's going to get and I'm so happy and things are perfect, well, I may as well transition now, and that'll just be the cream on top. It'll be great. I've got this amazing support network, amazing wife, beautiful kids, really successful business in a really sweet, loving community. I'm like, well, I can do it now because everything is perfect. And I lost it all very rapidly.
So it didn't turn out the way you...
No, disaster. It was devastating. I literally lost everything I've ever had to be the person I was always meant to be.
Wow, Em, that's full on. So was your wife the first person you spoke to?
No, she wasn't. It actually happened. It had been building up for about 6 or 7 months at that stage, not long after my daughter was born in November of 2015. And it was almost immediately after she was born, I was like, this is getting to me now. I've got to start really thinking about it. So that's when I really started researching the process of transition as it was today, around my doctors and things like that. And look, I had tried to come out quite often throughout my journey, throughout my 20s and things. And I always just needed a push. I needed someone to say, I will support you. But this time I was watching football with a friend of mine and I said to her, I'm a woman. I'm supposed to be a woman and my name is Emily. And I've always felt that way. And she was like, awesome. Then let's do it. I'll be here for you.
Wow.
Yeah. And I was like, really? And she's like, yes. And I'm like, okay.
So another significant person in your life has come in at a time when you really needed them. The first one was your colleague at the supermarket. who showed you that there's another way to live.
I can't even remember their name, sadly.
Yeah. It's amazing that they're so seminal. And then this friend has just said, whatever, let's do it.
Which, sadly, I'm no longer friends with that person. In some stage of my transition, they decided I was too difficult and cut me off entirely. But at least they were there at that stage to help me get there.
What happened next?
I decided I was transitioning. Like, it was the opposite of gender dysphoria. It was gender euphoria. It was like, oh my God, I am actually finally going to be who I'm always supposed to be. And I probably didn't really consider very well how that was going to affect the people who loved me, who is used to this guy that had been in their life forever.
When you're telling this story, your eyes have lit up.
About when I got to finally, I know. Yeah. Well, it was a seminal moment in my life.
Yeah. When we're talking about the difficult parts of it, you look normal, of course, but when you just said that this is what happened and your eyes have lit up the studio, seriously. Well,
it was just such a huge relief for it finally to happen.
So I
repressed it for so long.
Despite the journey that ensued after that, I can see that this is still an incredibly special thing for you. To finally be the Emily that you always wanted to be. Tell me about the name.
I just knew it was my name from about the age of 11. I know a lot of trans people that will go through 3 or 4 names in their first 18 months, 2 years of transition because it's not something they're used to. But I just knew my name was Emily from when I was about 11 or 12 years old.
You look like an Emily.
Well, thank you.
Now let's go back to the difficult stuff, coming out to your wife.
She struggled. I think she just kind of went into a fugue state. She just didn't know what to do. She kind of just had to go with it and deal with it as best she can. And if I could do everything again, I would try to do it so differently because I think I really stuffed it up. I really did not consider how it was impacting the people around me. I was celebrating this person I was always supposed to be and they were grieving someone they lost. So she tried her best. But after a while, it was too much. And with the way my relationship started to break down with my parents and my brother and a few of my support networks, my mental health started to disintegrate pretty badly. My brain was rewiring itself on a whole new hormone it hadn't been exposed to before. And I got incredibly ill and it just became too hard for everybody. And everyone just they obviously felt it was in their best interest to cut me loose.
When you say ill, do you mean mentally, physically, or both?
All of it, yeah. Mostly mentally. I mean, I got to the stage where I developed bipolar, which I still deal with now, pretty severe bipolar, in fact. And there was a few occasions where I got into such high stress. Like once I was told I had to leave my business and my parents were insisting I had to move away from the region and people weren't supposed to know, I guess in their minds they thought they were protecting me from a cold, harsh world. But at the same time, they're trying to protect themselves. So, yeah, all this pressure of being a brand new, non-passing trans person, having to find new housing, new job, and 2 children under the age of 3, it got to me. And I got to the stage where I got really ill and I started having like psychotic dissociative events. I would black out. I'd lose days. Apparently there was incidences when I was in those blackouts where I was actually to a degree physically abusive to my partner, which is obviously horribly traumatic to her. And it's been really hard for me to comprehend how I could do that. But at the same time, it was like I wasn't even present in those spaces because I have no memory of it.
Were you still living in the family home at
that
stage?
Yeah, we were.
How long did that last?
Because my wife is a Swedish citizen. She grew up in Sweden. I met her in Sweden. We thought it would be in our best interests to move to Sweden and start a whole new life there. So we sold our house, gave away all of our possessions, cleared out all of our connections to Australia. We moved to Sweden. After about a week in Sweden, I had another really severe mental health issue. My wife's family put me into a public psychiatric care ward in Sweden. I was there for a week. And then when the hospital let me out, they had to let me out because they said that my visa was no longer applicable to that country because I was there as a partner and my wife had signaled to them her intentions to separate from me. So
were you traveling on your male passport at that stage?
No, I had my passport with my affirmed name and affirmed gender on it. But even still, I was told I had to leave the country and then reapply for a new visa, because my partner visa was no longer going to be relevant. So yeah, then my wife or soon to be ex-wife and her father picked me up from the hospital, took me to a train station and left me there and said, off you go, see you later. Didn't even get to see my kids and say goodbye. So I just had to catch a train to Copenhagen and get on a plane and come back to Australia. And, yeah, I haven't seen any of them since. I get to Skype once a month with my babies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That must be incredibly difficult.
It sucks because I live for my children. My children are my whole life and my whole world, and I don't know whether I'll ever see them again.
How old are they now?
4 and 3.
Yeah. You must really want to keep in touch with them desperately just to wait till they're a little older mm-hmm. so you can explain your own version of events.
I hope so.
Yeah.
I can only hope so.
Yeah, I hope so too.
I mean, it's this horrible, horrible irony that I finally was able to transition because I became a mum, and then I lost my kids because I transitioned.
I feel like I want to cry, but
I'm going to hold it together. I'm going to hold it together for the both of us.
You're doing very well. Thank you for being strong for me. It's an incredible story. I thought I was coming to talk about football. And here we are talking about an incredibly challenging journey that you've had.
Yeah.
And it's still really fresh, obviously.
Yeah, I still live with it every day.
And your daily challenge is work, money, all of that stuff. Where are you living at the moment?
I'm renting in St. Kilda with a friend of mine, one of the girls I met through my football club at St. Kilda Sharks.
And we will talk about footy.
Yeah, we will.
Yeah.
I'm sure.
Because I love my footy too.
Yeah. So, yeah, I've been living with my housemate or housewife. We call each other housewives. Since the middle of last year, and she's been an amazing support for me. I've been amazing support for her.
But given you don't now have the support of your ex-wife, you're not seeing your children, your parents and your brother,
mm-hmm.
I'm assuming you're not seeing them at all.
No.
You know, that's a massive break in your support system.
Mm-hmm.
So living with someone who's a supportive person in a, you know, pretty eclectic kind of community,
yeah,
like St. Kilda.
I really love St. Kilda. There seems to be this real pressure for a lot of gender diverse and trans people in Melbourne to live around the Coburg, Brunswick, Preston area. That's like the safe space up there. But I feel like your transgender identity in those spaces can almost become all-consuming and the most pivotal aspect of who you are as a person. It's like being queer has become an arms race for a lot of people. Whereas in St. Kilda, it's just, you're just a St. Kilda person.
Yeah, you're just Emily Fox.
Yep. The queers have been living in St. Kilda forever.
I live in Elwood, so.
And we're still in there. I mean, I don't know whether, I remember when I was like a kid, early 2000s, and it was really, really obvious that it was a queer space. I don't know. St. Kilda feels a bit different to me now as I'm grown up. I don't know whether it's because I'm not so naive, but it seems to be either incredibly wealthy white people or the most down and out people.
Do you feel safe walking around the streets?
Mostly, yeah. Ironically, if I'm ever walking home at night, I'll often get cars pull up and ask me whether I'm working. Just because there's the assumption that if you're walking at night alone as a woman, you are a street sex worker.
If it helps, when I did live in St. Kilda, I also got the same.
Yeah, everyone does. Yep. And I always just say, nah, keep moving, mate. Nah. Not for me, because even though I have done sex work, it's like, yeah, my term and my time.
Do you want to talk about sex work? Obviously,
probably not.
It was a necessity for you at the time, but
yeah, look, I got to a stage where I was in a relationship where I was actually getting trafficked into it outside of my choice. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's not a space I really am too comfortable visiting. I've got to own the fact that I did it, and it's a more than valid choice of occupation for people, but it was not a space I wished I was in. Apparently I was good at it, but it's not something I really want to have on my resume.
How do you go financially now? Are you, given you're having trouble?
No, I'm super poor. I've got no money. I can't find work. It's very hard to find people willing to monetize my voice, people really comfortable or hoping that I can share my story and share my insights on anything, but they're not interested in paying for it, so I just got to keep trying to work at it, and hopefully one day that will happen.
Putting the word out here, people. Got new
That'd be nice.
Paid speaking work for Emily Fox.
I mean, I've done some panels over the last few years where you like pretty prominent people I share the panel with who have achieved a lot more publicly than anything I could ever have done, and it's interesting when you find out that they got paid significant amounts of money and I did not get a cent.
Let's talk about footy. You played football growing up?
Yes.
You love it?
I love it.
You're obviously good at it because you play for the St. Kilda Sharks.
I wouldn't say I'm good at football. but I love it enough that I can inject enough passion into it that I can get by as a player.
Would you aspire to the AFLW, or do you think that time has passed for you?
I'm too old.
Yeah.
I have too many injuries. I would have loved to have had that opportunity, but age is against me.
Sorry, if you'd been born a little bit earlier, later.
Yeah, no, but at the same time, I've got to acknowledge the fact that because I was assigned male at birth, I was actually allowed to play football when I was a kid. I actually had pathways and I had access to elite programs, and all the other girls I grew up with didn't. So that's something I've got to acknowledge. That's a massive privilege that all the other girls I'm playing football with never actually got to have. We've got girls in our team the same age as me, you know, mid to late 30s, who are playing their first or second year of football ever because they never had an access to it when they were kids.
What are your thoughts on the AFLW?
It's amazing that we've got it. It needs a lot of work.
In terms of?
Investment, respect by the governing body. I think that to expect these athletes to put in a 22-week preseason for a 7-game season at minimal pay, it's just ridiculous expectation placed on them. They should be rewarded. They should get a full season. It just needs to be respected more, and they should acknowledge that. If they acknowledge that, that would be fine, because then we can all like plan ways to work together. But yeah,
but they do have the AFL Men's as a prototype. So there is 100-something years of learning.
Yeah.
But yeah, as you say, it might be good for them to come out and say, hey, this is, you know, we're taking feedback and we're trying to perfect this thing, because it's not men's. It's based on the men's game, but it's not exactly the same. They have conferences and they have different, slightly different rules, different size ball.
Gender roles are imposed as from the day that we're born. Because of the gender that's imposed on us, there's expectations on how we behave and how we present ourselves. So when the vast majority of the people who are in control of the AFL are wealthy, white, straight, cisgender men, they've been taught since the day they were born that you can't own up to any kind of weakness. You can never admit to being wrong in anything you do. So in regards to AFLW, it's not being supported as it should.
Do they speak to women that are playing and have played for a long time in the St Kilda Sharks, that league? Do they seek advice?
We're not in the VFLW anymore. Mm. The AFL kicked us out of the VFLW. Oh. When with the AFLW coming in, the AFL has kind of taken over the VFLW, which was the premier women's league in the country, and they got rid of all the community clubs. So St Kilda Sharks, Eastern Devils, Diamond Creek, Seaford, Cranbourne, etc. These teams had been part of the VFLW for a long, long time, and then we were all kicked out. And unless you're affiliated with an AFL club or a VFL standalone club, so Sandringham or Williamstown, you just weren't allowed to participate anymore.
So St Kilda Sharks are not affiliated with any – they're not a feeder team for any
particular – No.
So not even – so St Kilda's getting their own women's team next year.
So they've currently got the Southern Saints in the VFLW, and they will be having the St Kilda Saints women's football team in the AFLW in the 2020 season. And the Southern Saints are currently aligned with Sandringham, which is great because the CEO of Sandy, David, is an incredibly strong advocate for – women's football, and also for queer inclusion in football. So I think that's going to bode really well for that club moving forward. Whether we can build a relationship with Sandringham and then on to St Kilda Saints, I'm not sure at this stage because we are purely a community-run club now. But the women involved in our club are amazing. Like Anne Fulton and Lisa Caddo, who are like the matriarchs of our club, women's football wouldn't exist in this country without those two women. Their experience and their knowledge should be really a lot more respected and utilised by the AFL. But, yeah, I don't know whether it is.
Yeah, it seems extraordinary that we did have two AFLW female coaches that have now lost to the system, and mm-hmm. it's all men coaching now.
Yeah.
And they seem to see the women's as a, like a, you know, vocational step for them to go and coach men.
And that is really frustrating for me. Like, Beck Goddard coaches Adelaide to a premiership in the first season. They do pretty well in the second season despite some horrible injury issues. And then all she requests is, well, you know, she's an AFLW premiership coach. She loves coaching. She's exceptionally good at it. She warrants a full-time job within the club. And they say, no, we can't offer you that. You're going to be the part-time AFLW coach or nothing. So she chooses to leave. She's got a career outside of that. She's got to look after her best interests. And then they immediately hire a dude to take the AFLW role and an assistant coach at the AFL time full-time. Just because it's a pathway program for the boys. Now, we're even seeing that now in women's football at a community level. There's probably still more male coaches than female coaches, and they're only, most of the men are doing it not because they're passionate about women's football. They're doing it because it's a pathway to coaching a better men's team.
What's the acceptance like for you down at St Kilda Sharks?
St Kilda Sharks, I've had zero problems at all since the day I got there.
Yeah.
But that, I was recruited to the club by Lisa and Anne, and you don't say no to those women because they are women's football and they wanted me there. And they're almost like, they're like my mums now, Lisa and Anne. I love them to bits, and I'm so honoured that they have allowed me to be a part of their life. Last year, I was just a player at the Sharks. I just wanted to come in and keep my head down and try to work hard, just be one of the team. But this year, I'm playing. I'm kind of working at becoming a development coach, doing skill development and even skill acquisition with some of the players. And I'm also on the committee now too. So, yeah, I'm invested wholeheartedly in that club, and that's because they want me there.
Well, it's perfect for them and for you because you have, as you were saying, you've had that pathway since you were a kid playing football. You've developed those skills over time. Yeah, you can share those.
I never, like, junior football, I was really passionate about it. It was the way I could fit in with the boys. And I was even lucky enough at one stage to be invited to do a trial pre-season with the state team, the New South Wales Rams. And I imagine at that time, if I was in a better headspace and more comfortable who I was, I would have easily made that team going on. But it was too much travel, too much hard work, and being around all these 16-year-old men, 17-year-old men, it was just such a toxic environment for this little queer thing that I couldn't deal. But I knew that I had some capabilities as a footballer at least. But when I had to transition into men's football, especially with my size, I'm not very big and I'm somewhat feminine, I guess. And yeah, I never played as much men's football as I would have liked to have because those environments were just too toxic and confronting.
Have you had any issues with, you said that St Kilda Sharks have been fantastic. What about opposition players and, you know, other teams?
Opposition players, for the most part, have been great. When I played my season up at Shepparton, I'd often get opposition players like come up after the game and literally hug me and say, it's so great I'm allowed to play football. And so, yeah, the reaction on the ground has probably been a lot more welcoming than what the perception outside of football would think it would be. I did have one incident last year where an opposition assistant coach gave a pretty horrible sledge at me. Not only was it a transphobic sledge, it was actually horribly misogynistic, and that's what I took more offence to, the way he was dismissive of women's football entirely. Essentially, the sledge was, he said, if you think you're a woman now, you should play like a girl.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. So obviously that offended me as a trans woman, but that's also grossly offensive to every single other woman who's playing football that day, including the girls on his team. He tried to apologise after the game and I didn't even accept his apology.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't worth it.
What do you think of the crazy argument about, well, you know, you've got men's genes and you're bigger or taller or whatever and it's an unfair competition?
It's such a loaded conversation. It's so ridiculous. I'm going to be spending a little bit of time again with the AFL, helping them put together their trans inclusion policy at community level. Because they've done their one for elite football now, but the community one's still pretty grey. Look, it's a challenging thing. I've been welcomed into women's football because I'm 164 centimetres. I'm 65 kilos. I'm not big.
No, I'm bigger than you.
Yeah,
I can take you on, Emily.
Bring it. Let's see. We'll have a wrestle after this interview. Yeah, like I am actually the average height and weight of an Australian woman according to the last census. So coming into that space, people haven't been intimidated by my size. For bigger girls, bigger trans women, it's been a lot harder for them to get accepted. But at the same time, there are cisgender athletes who are even bigger than those transgender athletes that people have been worried about.
Yeah, there's a lot of the, you know, they're recruiting a lot from basketball and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
These girls are big.
There's some
strapping,
big girls.
Beautiful women.
I was like, I stand next to a few of these AFLW players just through the spaces I move in, and they're massive.
Yeah,
they absolutely ragdoll me.
I'm assuming you don't play ruck, given your your stature.
One game last year, the coach put me in the ruck, and I ended up with a bruised kidney and missed 2 weeks from that. So, yeah, I'll never have to go in the ruck again. We actually had a really prominent AFL coach come down to our club last night, who's an ex-AFL ruckman, to work with the rucks at our team. And I literally said, like, we need to get this right because I've got an emotional investment in this because I'm never going in the ruck again, please. So, Yeah, when I played men's football, I was always a small forward or midfielder. But I also played as a marking forward as well, surprisingly, with my height, because I'm probably my best, biggest strength in football is my overhead marking and my leading, aware of timing to get into space to get the ball as a forward. But in women's football, I kind of just play where the coach tells me to play. I played all over the ground last year, and I'm pretty sure the coach has got some different ideas for how to use me again this year.
Are you training yet?
Oh, yeah. We started our preseason in November.
Yeah, I would have thought so.
Yeah.
When's the season start?
Our first game will be just after Anzac Day, so last weekend of April.
And home ground is?
Peanut Farm Reserve.
Still good.
Yeah, so it's perfect spot, beautiful ground, just behind Ackland Street. You can hear the people screaming on the roller coaster at Luna Park just on the other side of the street. And then you've got the beach just there as well. It's such a picturesque little place, and I really hope we can get a lot more people down to watch our games this year, because it's an incredible day out.
I used to go and watch the women's footy back in the 80s down there at the Peanut Farm.
Yeah. They've been playing football there for a long time, and I think we need to get better at actually showing the St Kilda community what a special little thing they have down there so we can get a lot more people to the games. I grew up playing country football where these little towns didn't have many people, but they'd all be at the football on a weekend. Then you come to Melbourne, you play football in Melbourne. I played men's football throughout the 2000s in Melbourne, and now I'm playing women's football. And, you know, you can have these teams with some highly talented players putting on a good show and 20 people around the boundary line. We get a lot more than that at the Sharks, but we always want more.
Also, putting the call out again, Saints footy, come down.
Oh, the Sharks are amazing, and we're so welcoming, and all new function centre this year. The City of Port Phillip have totally renovated our change rooms and function rooms, so... Yeah, it's going to be a really great year of footy, and it's got that amazing community feel. Everybody's welcome.
Now, tell me a little bit about acting. Can I throw something to you?
Yes.
Do you think, given your experience as a trans woman and coming to terms with that in your late teens and then basically hiding it from yourself and your loved ones for, about 10, 12 years, does that make you a better actor?
Definitely. That's one of my selling points, and it's almost like a joke, and it always elicits a laugh, but I always say, yeah, I've never had any formal acting training, but I did pretend to be a man for 30 something years. So I took method acting to the most extreme that you can, but I just didn't want to get typecast, you know, go out on a high. So yeah, never had any formal acting, but my whole life was acting.
Do you get much work?
No.
Why do you think that is?
It's because I'm transgender, and the agency I'm currently with are only really comfortable putting me up for transgender roles as both an extra and as a featured extra or with a speaking role. So, yeah, in the 18 months I've been with an agent, I've had a handful of jobs as an extra, and I've only been given one audition for a role, which I got, and it aired last week on ABC.
What did I miss?
I had a small role in episode 5 of season 2 of Get Crackin'.
Oh, Get Crackin'.
On ABC
I love those
TV.
Girls.
Yeah, the Kates are amazing, and I love being in that space. And the best part about that role was they specifically asked for a transgender actor because the Kates are really about improving diversity on Australian television. So even though they wanted a transgender actor for that role, the character wasn't necessarily transgender or cisgender. It was just a character.
Amazing.
And that was pretty awesome for me because it wasn't the typecast trans role. When I first started to put feelers out there to do acting, I'd get like student scripts, and I thought that'd be a good way. And nearly every single one that was written for a trans woman started off with the trope of the trans woman in front of the mirror, shaving her face and then putting on her makeup, you know? And I was like, that's not the reality of our lives, and stop peddling this story about what a trans person is. We're the mechanic that fixes your car. We're the person who serves you at the supermarket. We're the person doing your taxes. I don't want to have trans roles as an actor. I just want to be the soccer mum in a Toyota ad.
I can so see you as that, actually.
Well, I am a mum.
Yeah, exactly. You're
and parent, you know what? You know. I've got plenty of trans women friends who literally do that. They take their kids to football training and then take them home, and that's just their reality. But in popular media, popular culture, we're still either highly sexualized or our gender identity is perceived to be performative or fetishized, and it's so far against the reality of what a modern day trans person's existence is, but it's just not reflected. And that's why I don't get any auditions, because the few trans roles that are written are usually for trans women who look like cis women anyway, and that's not me.
And do you think they're more, in my experience, they're more stereotyped. They're often just, you know, trans women are sex workers or they die tragically or, you know, they're not generally positive.
Yep. You're either a joke or a tragedy or a combination of. And there's no real nuance. There's no real representation of just the everyday life of what a transgender person would be.
Are you inspired by the slow changing of Hollywood in terms of that?
Yes and no. I know there's a lot of, you know, a lot more respect paid for the concept that they can't keep casting cisgender actors to play transgender roles. That's really positive. One thing that frustrates me is in Hollywood and American television that the only roles that go to transgender women are trans women who look like cis women. That whole concept of passing that we spoke about earlier. And more power to them. I mean, if they've got the ability to look that way and present that way, that's amazing, you know, for them. But once again, it's not a real accurate representation of trans people. You could then argue that this, like the cisgender people in acting are also incredibly attractive and amazing. But, you know, Steve Buscemi's not the most handsome-looking bloke, but he gets plenty of work.
No, true. And there is that argument too of, well, we need to have a famous cisgendered woman to play a trans woman because otherwise we can't sell the project. I get the financial business.
Even then, it's very rare they cast a cisgender woman to play a trans woman. They always cast cisgender men to play trans women. And then they can build on that trope. It's the Eddie Redmaynes and the Jared Letos and these guys who are playing the trans women. And everyone's like, oh my God, what a courageous role. How special. And
Oscar-worthy.
Oscar-worthy, and they just ham it up. Just so not accurate. Sorry about the poor grammar there, but it's just so not accurate. Mm. And, yeah, they get all these kudos for taking such a brave, powerful role. It's like, yeah, but that's just our everyday life.
Yeah, you're just getting on with stuff.
Yeah. I just play footy with my mates and cook dinner for my friends, and we, on Sunday night, we all went out bowling, like, that's what we do.
It's all very boring.
Yeah, myself and six of my footy teammates. So six cisgender women, one transgender woman, but it's just a bunch of girls going out bowling on a Sunday afternoon having a few drinks.
What's the future for Emily?
I don't know and I don't care.
You're not looking too far ahead?
No, I can't. When you get to the stage of your life where you've lost everything you've ever had, I just kind of accept the fact, well, that just means I've got nothing left to lose, so I don't make any plans.
It's a very positive way to look at things.
It could be. It also could be quite nihilistic, which is not necessarily a bad thing either.
Sounds like a good survival plan to me.
It is, essentially. I can't concentrate on what my future's going to be like because if it doesn't go the way I hope it does, then it's just more disappointment.
What do you hope?
Honestly, the only thing I hope for is to make it life and the world better for the other transgender people around me, especially trans kids. I don't want them to have to grow up with the shame and the fear and the confusion that I grew up with. I want to see transgender kids be given their best chance to live their best life. And that's all that really matters for me. I want my transgender siblings to get jobs and secure housing and be loved and supported and cared for. That's all that matters to me.
Well, I think the fact that you're speaking to me today, you're obviously really busy as an advocate, even though you don't get paid, let's be honest. You're playing footy. You're out and proud, and I just really want to thank you for sharing your amazing life so far. You're such a young person, and you've been through so much. It's been incredible to chat to you, and I just wish the best for you.
Thank you, Lisa.
And I hope everything turns out really well, and good luck for this season with the Sage Shark.
Yeah, come down and watch us. I'll take some hangers for you.
Please. I love a good hanger. Hey, thanks, Em.
Thank you, Lisa. I appreciate it.
Word for Word is presented and produced by Lisa Daniel, with production support by Chris Tate from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 stations across the community radio network.
If you're experiencing difficulty, please reach out for support. You can reach QLife, an anonymous and free LGBTI support service, by calling 1800 184 527 or call Lifeline 24 hours a day on 131114 for crisis support and suicide prevention. In an emergency, please call 000.
What keep listening to great stories from a queer perspective? Well, Word for Word is available on podcast via the Joy website or iTunes. So head to iTunes and get downloading. And while you're there, why not give us a 5-star rating, review us and subscribe? Just search Word for Word Joy in iTunes. Joy Podcasts, where you want them, when you want them.
Feet on the catwalk. Could we